this show is not for the easily offended. So if you are easily offended, go listen to something else.
I'm guessing it's 376.
Yeah, that's a number.
Woo!
But do you trust me?
It's Indie Comic Book Noise, a podcast sponsored by nobody, listened to by some.
Nobody.
Nobody knows.
Is this your way to slip in some Family Circus comics?
There you go. As long as
I love when the kid followed that path. Yeah. That was the only thing I liked that the Family Circle was following that path every month.
Mm-hmm. So they had nobody.
Did it go anywhere?
Yeah. No, he just went to get the Bapler or something.
Especially on Sundays, it went somewhere because it was big and in color. That was the deal.
60 years, that comic hasn't gone anywhere.
That was one of the boring ones that I skipped.
Oh, you're too busy flipping to Hagar the Horrible.
I don't want to.
Oh, that was good stuff. Hagar the Horrible. And then I would try to read Marmaduke and everything, and I'd be like, this isn't really for me.
Yeah, it's because you're a cat lady.
Yeah, probably. And then I know, like, Kathy.
You're two boobs away from becoming a cat lady.
Every Kathy one was hilarious because she would do this. It would be the same thing every time. She'd be like, time to get ready for work. And then, like, she'd get, like, some kind of stain or something, and then she would try to wipe it up or something. It would just get worse and worse, and she'd be like, oh, no, what am I going to do? I'd be late, blah, blah.
I believe she went, ack, was her. Mm. Wasn't that her exclamation?
Yeah.
Or was that Garfield? Or was that Bill the Cat?
You know, there were some that were never in there, though. Like, we never got any of the, usually the adventurous strips. It was more like the comedy type of things.
I once did Bill the Cat acid in high school. Little Bill the Cat.
Did squares. You see Bill the Cat?
No.
So did Berkeley Breathe license that?
I wouldn't be surprised. That was in the heyday. I had a great Bill the Cat t-shirt, too. Man, good looking
that
cat.
That was a good strip.
It was.
That was a good. Remember when they had the flexi disc that came with the compilation and you could hear the Billy and the Boingers or whatever the band was called?
All right, guys. What you been
good
reading?
Good times, kids.
What you been reading indie-wise?
Who are we? Did we say who we are?
We are.
No, we didn't.
Your collective unconscious.
They don't care.
Just completely unrestrained.
All right. So we can get around to the stuff that disappointed us this year. Oh, wait, this year? That doesn't make sense.
Speaking of disappointments, I'm Steve Raker from the Comic Book Bunker. There you go, Kevin.
I think I'm Kevin from the Melting North. Phil might be from there as well. I don't know how his weather is.
It's nice again.
Yeah.
Thanks to global warming. Yes.
I thought we were getting rid of that.
It's cold in New York.
I like it. I want a tropical Ottawa.
It's cold here.
It's cold here in Los Angeles. This is Andrew dialing in. And it is cold and rainy.
Yeah, you got to substitute Andrew's cold for, like, yeah. you got to get
yeah,
up.
Yeah, Andrew's there. A big fucking wimp.
It's like 60. Like,
he'll cold.
At some point, I want to get into talking about the new Shadow book, the one that Colin Bunn's writing, because I'm digging it, but I want to finish reading all the issues before I mention it, so I can stay contemporary. But I read a 48-page special from, well, now last year, 2015, from Dynamite, that was the Shadow number 100. That was a one-shot with a really nice Matt Wagner cover.
Are they at 100, or they mean like it's like 100 for
it was just
some
a one
reason.
It was just a one shot, and it was, I think, between the series or right around the time that the issue number one came out of the new Bun series, written series. But this was an anthology book with six stories, even though five are only listed on the credits page, which is really weird. I had to keep flipping back and be like, wait a minute, which one isn't credited? And they even number them: story one, story two credits, story three credits, and there's a list five, but there's six 8-page stories. The first one, though, is written and drawn by Francesco Francavilla.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's what he's been doing.
And where's my Archie's asshole?
And it looks great.
Oh, didn't Wasn't there something about like season two of the Archie Horror was supposed to be starting?
Who cares?
There was like there was like an issue of that second arc, I think, one or two. But oh, and then Archie Five came out of the new Fiona Staples-y Mark Waid one. Remember we were just talking about how it seemed like that was off track, but
yeah, that's still going.
Yeah, I guess it's still on schedule. But anyway, this Francavilla shadow story, there are parts of it where he's like channeling some Kubert. Joe Kubert in the faces and stuff, which is great. And it's just a creepy, like, what happens focusing kind of on the criminal's point of view when they're caught and, like, what they would rather face than dealing with the shadow. It really makes him be a force of nature, and it's all red and black like you want a Francavilla piece to be. The second story is written by Victor Gishler with art by Stephen B. Scott, who I'm not familiar with, but this was cool. It was the shadow catching this crook who's working with a dirty cop. They've got like a scheme going, and the shadow uses this crook to set up the cop so that he ends up confessing like right in front of his brothers in blue, which is always a nice little gotcha at the end of these shadow tales. The third story is written and drawn by Howie Chaykin, and it's called Black and White and Red All Over, and it's funny. It's a period piece with a lot of Chaykin's textures on the zoot suits, you know? But it's not too bad. And there's an adventure that's sort of like the Shadow's experience kind of parallels his character's move from the pulps into comic books back in the day and like the rise of comic books. And it's kind of focuses around a comic book company that has some shady dealings that's trying to, a little bit Martin Goodman-like of, like, trying to kind of find what's going to be the next thing and whether comic books is going to work or not. It was Chaykin, obviously, doing a little meta stuff there. The fourth story was my favorite, though, written by Michael Uslan, who we know from the Batman movie stuff and whatnot, and drawn by Giovanni Timpano. And in the opening pages, the shadow completely interrupts, like, the Batman parents' murder thing from happening. Right outside Zorro, the whole deal, except the shadow comes in and just blows the crook away. And the boy, like, you know, the equivalent of the Bruce, young Bruce, looks up at the shadow and he's like, oh, man, you're the shadow. You're the coolest. I love that radio show. You know, it's, you know, you're my favorite hero kind of thing. And the shadow's like, oh, that radio show really bothers me. And he's all ticked about it. And he's like, his problem is they're profiting on the behavior of criminals. The way it was almost like a Steve Ditko bunch of logic, right? But it works. It seems, you know, Ditko could be the shadow in some ways. The way he thinks with his good and evil. So the shadow is basically saying, oh, you know, that radio show, I got to stop what they're doing. And the kid's like, it's my favorite show. And then that scene ends. And sure enough, after they are broadcasting a night of the old shadow radio drama, the unnamed actor goes on the elevator down to the parking garage and encounters the shadow, who wants to scare the bejeebas out of him. And he uses, he basically says, like, you know, he says the same thing I was just saying, that you know, you're profiting off this crime stuff and that you shouldn't do this and you're an intelligent man. And he's like, I'm just some voice actor. And he's like, no, you're a smart guy and an intellectual, and I'll make you a bargain. If you stop doing this show and put your talents to good work, to good use, for the betterment of mankind, I'll let you live. And he's like, what? Are you, like, serious? You got to be kidding, right? And he's like, no. And then he quotes Robert Herrick. He says, gather ye rosebuds while ye may. And he disappears, right? And so then the last few panels just flash to the, now you notice, a little bit pudgy actor comes running out of the elevator all flustered, and out in front of the building that he walks out of is a newspaper boy, and he's got a newspaper in his hand where it's the news about Hearst newspapers really being having lied about various scenarios that pushed, at the turn of the century, pushed America into the Spanish-American War against Spain. And this actor, voice actor, looks down at that paper and that headline. This is going somewhere. This has a payoff, I promise. He looks down and he says, Rosebuds. He connects it with what the shadow says to him. And then you just get the shadow laughing and a wide shot of, like, the city street. And the deal is, the actor is Orson Welles. Orson Welles played the shadow voice acting before his career for a very short time in his 20s, and then went on to co-write, direct, and star in Citizen Kane, right? Which had the tie into this Spanish-American War and ended with the, it's Rosebuds, right? That's the whole thing of Citizen Kane, is the Rosebuds, and then trying to figure out what's the significance, and they miss that it was part of his sled or chair or something that burns up, and all the press and everything miss what the significance of Rosebud was, and it was tied into him, and that, like, no one really knew who he was and all this. It was, Citizen Kane, basically. I'm not going to take the whole time to explain that, but
I refuse to watch that movie.
But it's a very cool way that Uslan tied that in and made the shadow be like the linchpin for Orson Welles leaving that role and going on to do Citizen Kane. I thought it was very clever, and all in 8 pages. Then there's still the Matt Wagner story, which is he writes in prose and just has some spot illos. And then the uncredited story, who I don't know who wrote or drew it, where there's this, like, two-bit crook who, he keeps getting the opportunity to be, like, more of a criminal and get into, like, the murder racket and more violent crimes, but he keeps saying no to that. He wants to stay where he doesn't really know his victims and he doesn't have to hurt anybody and more of a burglar type, running numbers type. But the shadow is everywhere. Like, he keeps, like, destroying his operations left and right, and finally he decides, you know what, I'm just going to leave town. This is just ridiculous. I'm not going to become more of a criminal, and I'm not going to survive doing this. But on his way, catching the boat out of town, the shadow catches up with him. He's like, please, Mr. Shadow, like, let me live, the shadow basically reads him his whole deal. Is like, dude, you got a conscience. You've got all these ties to all these criminal organizations and these crooks, but you've never hurt anybody. You've never tried to hurt anybody. You've got this moral compass. And he sets him up to stay in town and to be one of his informants. So it's like the story of sort of how one of the Shadow's networks of informants, which he relies on throughout every iteration of the Shadow's presentation, how one of those guys gets established. Really cool. For 48 pages, it gives you a real taste of different Shadow stories. It's a character I've always been fond of, but the stories and the comics for him haven't always been up to par. But every one of them was worth a read. 48 pages, The Shadow, number 100.
I wonder how many times a Batman origin has been done somewhere or something like that.
By Michael Uslan alone, how many times it's been done.
Yeah, I don't know if you read that Dark Horse anthology, that noir thing. It had something where it was like the pearls were in there and like all this stuff, and you didn't know until the end of the story where it was sort of like taking place before like the murder in the alleyway, and it was just like, what?
The pearls were in this one too, of course. But I thought...
Yeah, I always loved the... those radio shows with Orson Welles, the Shadow, and a bunch of the War of the Worlds and all that stuff.
Yeah. But it was just cool that some of the references at the end of that story and the Rosebuds and then the Herrick poem, and it made me start looking some stuff up and be like, oh, cool. Like, oh, now, all right, it's well. Like, that was just a fun adventure as a reader to go through that and then have the aha moment of seeing what the heck the context was for that. I was really enjoyed it. Gonna make me go first and say who goes next?
Come on, Andrew, step up to the plate. Something that ties in.
Okay. So when is a DC comic, not a DC comic, but an indie comic, when it's published by someone else?
Wow.
So as I teased, I wanted to just briefly talk about from Tash and Press. For Christmas, we got a bunch of these little books. And I got the little book of Superman, little book of Wonder Woman, little book of Batman.
Ooh. Oh, I'm going to call it foul. That's nope. pretty, that's nope. cutting it pretty close. I don't know.
He makes it.
So, as you guys may recall, that Tashin does those big books, the whole 75 years of DC, but they also cut the material different ways because he already put it all together, so why not make the most of it?
Yeah, I just bought
I wondered about these.
Yeah, I just bought the Bronze Age oversize hardcover that's like part of that big 75 years one of the DC. You know, they broke it down
broke it down into eras.
Right.
And this way they broke it into characters, but they did it in little small small handy ones. And what's kind of fun about it is it has a little goofy text piece in the beginning about whatever the character is and blah, 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 but it's all just a collection of images. So they'll do covers, original art, interiors, but they also have weird things like the Batman Golden Storyteller Record comic and pictures of stills from, like, remember they did a Batman serial as in a movie serial where they used to do little segments of it and little promotional pictures. And so what they do is in the captions, that's where they put more of the text where they talk about a little bit of the historical reference of, you know, what's going on in the comic at the time or some point they want to make about the issue. Sometimes it's just the credits, but other times they'll say, like, oh, this guy, he's doing his best to emulate Bob Kane's style, but he was more natural. You know, a little description of his, what's going on in it. They're just kind of fun because I can stare at old covers all day. I mean, it goes right up to the modern time, but who's reading any of that stuff?
Yeah.
And additionally, I really enjoy, I like that kind of weird ephemera. For a character like Batman, so there's stuff from the TV show, there's stuff from foreign editions, you know, like nothing like crazy, you know, German Batman or Swedish Batman or the board game or like a something out of like Mad Magazine type, little weird toys and all that stuff. So it's just kind of a fun, I mean, it's not really something you read, right, but it's just kind of a fun book to flip through and have fun. And it's a way to have a little Batman, one of my favorite indie characters.
Sure. No, I was wondering if they had different stuff in there than all the other bigger editions they've done.
No, I mean, they might, but they seem to, I would guess, I haven't done a side-by-side comparison because I have the Marvel one, I don't have the DC one. But I get, from the credits, I take it, it's pretty much all lifted from there. There might be a little supplemental stuff, but
yeah,
I would say if you have a big book, you probably don't need this. But on the other hand, that big book is really big.
It's too big.
Like the Marvel one is crazy.
Yeah.
But that DC one, I don't know how you read it.
Yeah.
Like, well, didn't they break it down into smaller chunks?
Right. That's what
that's
I
what
did.
Steve was saying.
I bought the Bronze Age one or the Silver Age one or something.
Nothing wrong with that at all. How about, since he wanted to throw me into the bus, let's put Kevin on the spot.
Oh, you want to throw me under the bus?
Yeah, for you wanting to squish poor Batman. Guy doesn't get any coverage. We're trying to help out these little-known characters.
Yep. I know.
Not heard publishers.
And it's not like he's, like, keeping a publisher afloat or anything like that either. It's not like he stole a movie from another character at the same publisher either.
How great is Tashin, though? Those books, they, like, you can even buy a book of stuff that you're not even sure if it's going to be great, and it's usually pretty great. Their presentations are so good, and their historical pieces that accompany are usually quite entertaining. My favorite one, I think, is the Men's Adventure one, where it's like all the covers of old like Men's Adventure magazines, and it's, you know, like Weasels Rip My Flesh and all that stuff. It's hilarious. And guys swimming in, you know, piranha waters trying to save girls and stuff, and you get the accompanying text to put it all in context. Very enjoyable, entertaining, and like you said, great to just flip through now and again just to get a flavor. I think they did one of, like, all skull imagery and different pulp covers, and always good.
All right, I think Kevin, you read something that I read, Steve.
Yeah, I was going to say that gave you time to get ready.
What?
Let It Fly. What you got?
I'm wondering if anyone will guess what we're talking about. It's a little image book, I believe it is.
Not
with
the first
the creepy, with the creepy eyeball on the back.
No. Oh. The Eye of Sauron.
Or Cthulhu, or the Eye from Another Universe looking into our universe. I'm not quite sure how we're supposed to interpret the giant eyeball.
We'll see. I think we'll get a chance.
But anyways, I think we're talking about Monstrous.
Yay! Finally.
I know. I it's weird that we both read it on the same day. I'm like, what are the odds that's going to happen?
I first heard about this book, I guess, in June, when I met Marjorie Liu, the writer, at the New York Comic-Con Special Edition thing. And she had the posters for it, and she told me the whole pitch of what it was about, because I went up to her talking about how much I enjoyed her work with Sana Takeda, who's the artist on this book, back when they were working for Marvel and doing the X-23 stuff. So I was saying, you know, what's Sana doing now? And she's like, well, as a matter of fact, we're doing this, and it's all done. The first few issues are all in the can, but Image is choosing their marketing strategy of when best to put out the new book. And they've been giving that a lot of thought this year, and they're holding it off till, like, November, she said. And this was back in June. So she said, that's just going to give us more time to have more in the can, so this thing is just going to keep coming out. And she's, you know, she said it's a little tricky now because she's trying to promote a book that isn't out there yet, but once it starts rolling, it's going to be rolling, and the first issue is way oversized. And boy,
no.
She wasn't kidding.
Yeah. Like, $4.99, but, like, tons of content, like tons of world building and everything.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that isn't my favorite way of the narrative running is there is a lot of time shift scene jumping, and it happens.
I was thinking of Andrew.
Yeah, it happens pretty quick, from the start of the book, and in my difficulty getting into the world of new concepts and characters from the jumping on point, I kind of need there to be some linear. I want to be in a position to want to know more before you give me that jump back where it's like, huh, okay, maybe this is going to tell me more. Whereas when it happens all jumping back and forth throughout the entire narrative, I just have to hang on like it's a roller coaster and accept what comes in and figure out at some point this is all going to make sense and orient me. But I kind of like to stick with the sort of linear narrative, and then once that's really been established and you're comfortable, then start upsetting the apple cart a little bit with some knowledge. So that piece of it was a little tricky for me, but you know, Lou's a good storyteller, and as is Takeda, and by the second issue, I am, you know, fully comfortable with where they have us.
Yeah, I didn't find that too bad. I think because they would make reference to something, and then they would have like something about that in the flashback where it's like, I have these powers, but they're not showing up. And you're sort of like, well, does she have these powers? And then you flash back, and then she keeps on trying to do something, and it's just not happening. And then you things go on and on and on, and eventually something happens. And once it happens, it's like, you're like, whoa, this is going to mean something. Like, our story's in motion.
It's a disturbing world, too, where it seems like it's sort of like magic.
Steampunk?
Yeah, well, it's got certainly that aspect to it. And how great is Takeda's, like, noodling of, like, on the flowing cloaks and stuff, where she starts, like, noodling in all that, like, what I guess would be embroidery. Define noodling. Lines that look like a big hot plate of spaghetti mess from a distance, but when you get close, you see that it's all intricate little twirls and things that are cross-hatching and layering over each other. She just works this really nice embroidered work over her, you know, like window edges and cloaks and just really cool stuff.
Okay, because I think there's a pervert version of that too.
I'm not spooning. But there's like arcanic, magic-oriented type folk, and it seems like humans, and they're separated by a wall, and this is making it utterly simplistic, and there is some horrific activity by some factions where they are capturing like little magic youths and chopping off pieces of them and using them to create some sort of elixir.
Magicite.
Yeah. But it's horrible. It makes me think of like the stories in the news that I've heard about like the albinos in is it in Africa, or I forget the exact geographic location, but where it's like if you're an albino kid, there's this there's these stereotypes of magical properties, and like the families have their houses broken into and their kids' limbs chopped off, and they say, and next time we're going to come back for another arm. So you have all these kids, you know, maimed and amputees, forced amputees by people with machetes taking their arms to sell them on the black market, or fingers or toes, because they think there's magic properties related to that. And I mean, that just jumped right in. The heroine herself is her left arm. She's amputated from the elbow down. This is a horrific world. I mean, it's a horrible world in general that we eat other living things to sustain ourselves. But then there's this other aspect of this horror of it's horrible when you see people doing horrible things to each other, and especially in the name of sustaining themselves, which you still don't know what this elixir does fully, but it seems like they need it or want it.
So, Kevin, what do you think of the book you wanted to review? I like that trick. I'm going to remember that. Review something Steve loves so you don't have to do shit.
I know. No, it definitely reminds me of some anime things, but mixed in with like real world horror or like war stories. Because, yeah, there's a wall, but there's like basically a truce. But, you know, it's not really a truce, and it's more like a Cold War. It's just a stalemate, like something horrible happened, and now they have not been fighting for a while, but
they still
the stuff.
I really regret not picking up that first issue, because I saw it that day, and usually I pick up the number ones, but I don't know why I didn't do it, and then it was sold out when I tried the next week.
Yeah, and then there's even, like, you see the propaganda going on, like, oh, or this, like, you hear from both sides, like, what happened at this battle, but one side says, no, this happened, or the other side doesn't have the abilities to make this happen, so you're hearing, like, I suppose one side could be correct, but you kind of wonder what did happen.
Yeah.
Like, if you're trying to make one side be, like, less horrific, but then the other side's like, well, if they believe that, like, we can also, like, turn that up a notch and use that for our advantage, even if we're not really like that. And I'm just like, that is just, it's just terrible. And then there's other mysteries going on that I find are interesting with the main character, where they're trying to find out about their mother.
Right.
But the title of the book actually comes from, it seems like, she's turning into like this monster, and I just happen to think of Dragon Ball with like Goku, like turning into this big 100-foot, I don't know, like werewolf type of thing, and just like totally destroying a town. Like I kind of expect her to do something crazy like that.
Agreed. I think it's coming. I love the color palette that Takeda uses too. Like there's these golds and browns and earth tones that are kind of scattered throughout, and some of the colors are muted, but it makes it very enchanted in a way. I really like her style.
Reminds me of some Final Fantasy artwork too, like these big crazy monsters and like technological things they would show, and of course with all the crazy detail, like even the guns and like everything is just, and it has like some person like, the, if they were creating these in this world, it would be like spending just hours and hours just adding all this extra detail to something that's just going to be used to kill someone or whatever. It's not just like they're trying to perfect the blade. It's like, well, we need more of the... we need more of these symbols or whatever on this thing because everything is so specific.
And that adds to Takeda's ornamentation of the noodling, as we said before. It, again, very cool book. Worth taking a ride on for sure. Especially since you get so much story in that first issue, even just to pick it up digitally to see if it's your cuppa, it's worth it.
Yeah. The two-tailed cat. Like, there's just random stuff like that in here, and I'm like, what is going on there? Or then the... Like, you have some... with the talking, I was just thinking of... in Inuyasha, they had... like, sort of like the fox kid type of... he joins the gang in that anime anyways, and it's sort of... Like, you see some sort of people that are... like half tails and stuff like that, and it sort of reminds me of some characters like that too.
I love when she's running through the woods at night and like the Cthulhu-y eye with the tentacles are all like hanging down from the sky, you know, and it's just like it's got that whole enchanted forest vibe. It's got that whole nighttime with the luminescent like fairy light vibe going, and then there's this big Cthulhu thing with the eye sticking out of the sky. I mean, oh man. This is a really cool imagery.
Yeah, and I'm thinking, she's hallucinating this, right? Because you're never quite sure sometimes what exactly she's seeing and what's going on. Because she, you never know if she's going to pop out into be some big giant creature at any moment. And then they have like this history lesson at the end of the second issue as well.
From Professor
which
Tam-Tam.
It looks like. Which it looks like a four-tailed cat here.
Yeah.
It's like giving you the lowdown on things.
Multi-tailed. He's full of tails.
Yeah. Apparently.
One tail after
He's telling some tails, too.
Exactly. There you go.
Yeah. But yeah, I was very impressed. Like, I'm going to be... Like, I just pre-ordered the issues rather than adding them to the pull list right away. Because I'm just like, well, I'm gonna like the way it looks anyway. So it's not really much of a gamble. And then I'm like, yeah. For sure, adding this long-term, the type of story I want to read.
From talking to Ms. Liu, I was excited and looking forward to the book, and my expectations were completely met. It was great. Phil,
all
you're
right,
up.
Phil. I think you're the only one left.
I recently read the third Grindhouse trade. There's four out completely. The first one had, like, Bee Vixens from Mars and a prison one in space.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was Bride of Blood and Flesh Feast of the Devil Doll. And then the fourth one, I think, are two space ones. But this third one is one of my favorites. These are all done by Alex DeCampi, who did the Predator versus Archie.
Yep.
And the other series I like, No Mercy, where it's the bus that breaks down in, like, Mexico or whatever, and they're in the desert and stuff.
Yep. I just started last night while I was doing some work listening to a recent Word Balloon podcast interview with Alex DeCampi with our pal John Suntress.
Oh, cool.
Check that out. It's really good. It's just from it's from December or the end of November.
Okay, yeah, she's one of my favorite newcomers for sure. And so this one, the third book, is really cool. It's their trades are awesome because they're like flip books. And each story is a 48-page story, and she always does a great job of giving all the information you need in just 48 pages with, like, a good ending. And has lots of extras, like little comic strips and stuff. Like, there's one about a burger joint where when you sit on the toilet, it, like, grinds you up, and your ass meat is the burger meat. Like, just weird things like that, or, like, old Grindhouse posters and... And it's almost hard to believe sometimes that this is a girl writing it. And so this one was really cool because it had Blood Lagoon, which was basically a sequel to Bee Vixens from Mars, except this time the surviving members had to go against giant ticks. So it's kind of the same type of story. Probably my least favorite out of all of the stories, but still very good, though. And then the other one is Sleigh Ride, which is probably my favorite story yet. And it's a tale that takes place on Christmas Eve in, I think it's Edmonton, like out in the middle of nowhere. There's just like a few houses around. And it's about, I think they're kind of like gods of death or something. But like one's called the cowboy, there's the clown, the overseer, and the man who walks. Like they're these really creepy dudes, always smiling, like a really creepy look to them. And one of them strangled one of the main characters, and it showed that she was like a swinger, like into threesomes and lesbian sex and guys noodling her and stuff.
What's noodling?
This is the noodling episode.
It's the real version of the word. You don't want to know, though. And it's just the way she writes it is just so creepy, the way these, when these characters like the cowboy pop up and the cowboy just points a finger at you and then says bang and then like your brains blow out. And it's just them going around killing the families in these homes on Christmas Eve. And it's just like she's good with dialogue. The art is amazing. It's always different artists. This one was R.M. Guerrera. I don't know how to pronounce his name. I forget what he's done, but I know.
Scalped,
yes, that's it. Yeah. And he does an awesome job with the snow and the backgrounds and everything. And just the horror element to it. Grindhouse is a great, great book series. You should really collect and trade. I hope she does more of it, but it seems like her hands are getting fuller now, so I don't know if she'll be doing a third season.
She had a busy year.
Yeah, and I know the bigger companies are picking her up now.
The vibe I got from the first part of the interview I listened to suggested that the Grindhouse thing was only intended to be 12, but it cooked along so nicely that they got the 24 out of it.
Yeah. Did she say what she had upcoming or anything?
I haven't gotten that far into. She's still talking about No Mercy and about the Grindhouse stuff. And
mm-hmm.
Well, I shot my wad on The Shadow and Monstrous, so Andrew, what else you got?
Well, while I'm continuing to Trojan horse indie comic book noise to talk about inappropriate manners, let's talk about a little thing that came out at the end of the year featuring Colleen Doran, Peter David, and Stan the Man.
Superman, Man of Steel?
Amazing, Fantastic, Incredible, A Marvelous Memoir, which is the Stan Lee graphic novel biography from Touchstone. I'm not familiar with them, but I assume people who read grown-up books probably know who they are. And this is yet another Stan Lee biography.
But it's drawn.
But this one's told as a comic.
Right. Yeah.
And I like you guys have so many of these books. Like, you guys must spend like hundreds of dollars on these things. Like,
well, sometimes I read them out of the library. But this one I did get a copy of. And I know what's interesting about this is they chose to tell it in kind of a conversational style, so it jumps around in time, sort of like Stan is kind of dictating it in a way, which I enjoyed. Because let's be honest, there's going to be some... we're not taking this as 100% fact, and I don't mean that in a malicious way. I just mean he's 2 years old or something, and... I had trouble remembering what happened last week, so if someone's going to quiz me about 80 years worth of my life, more, because it starts with him as a little kid.
Quick, was on the first episode of Indie Comic Book Noise?
I don't...
Halloween stuff.
I don't know. Talking.
Archie. Afterlife with Archie.
Walking Dead.
Twisted Tales from Pacific Comics way back when.
Yeah, you better not quiz Andrew.
Yeah. And so it's just a fun, I like Colleen. I remember as a kid reading A Distant Soil was her big work.
Sure.
From in the Wayback Machine. I think she might have picked it back up again, but I don't know if it'll ever, like that was for me a time and a place.
Yeah, I think I saw it recently in previews not too long ago.
But it suits well, you know, she can handle the likenesses while still making it a comic book, which is always a difficult line because I don't really want some kind of thing that just looks like a photo book.
Right.
But you also want to know who the heck she's talking about when the text... And there was actually a few funny moments in it. I assume that's Peter David. But
that's why I picked it up. It's like Peter David is going to tell Stan's story. All right, let's do that.
I love his humor. He has a good sense of humor. Him.
He does. Have you ever seen the books of Peter David's "But I Digress" columns from the Comics Journal, all collected? There are two of them.
No.
"But I Digress" might just be the first one, and the other one is like more digressions. I think the first one's out of print, but the second one you can totally still get, like through Amazon and stuff, I think. But it's just, you know, page after page of his articles from, you know, around the calendar for Comics Journal, and they're great. I mean, they cover everything from, you know, Ditko Stan Spidey stuff to things about his work to, and you just get a sense of his humor and comics history, and he gets a lot of reaction to his columns, and he reacts to the criticisms of his columns in like the next column and stuff, and it makes for a lot of fun reading. Like his longtime cordial yet very real feud with John Byrne, and it's really fun to get to read short snippets of bits of like what Peter David's thinking on any particular day about the industry. Very fun. Check them out.
Yeah, and so I think while this isn't, I mean, it's pretty comprehensive. I don't think you're going to learn too much new. I mean, I think I probably learned a few things, but it's a fun way to tell the story. He has had an impact. He does give, you know, light to Jack and Steve and everybody. It's not like he railroads that, and this is not the place to settle those feuds, I guess, in a way. I mean, you're never really going to settle them, and particularly not with a autobiography or I don't even know how much input Stan had. I mean, I assume Peter talked to him, but it reads like a Peter David book, so I was really pleasantly surprised with it. And it's funny, I always kind of bag on Stan and everything, but every time I see him talk or read stuff about him, like, he's been putting on a show for, you know, when he started doing those lectures in the 70s or whatever, so he really knows how to please the crowd and how to work around and everything. You don't do something for 50 years without getting pretty decent at it. So while I get kind of dismissive every time I do go down that road, I'm like, oh yeah, it's kind of fun. And Steve, did you get to this yet, or have you, I don't know.
I haven't read it. I have it on my shelf, but I haven't read it. I flipped through it to see what the vibe was, but haven't done it front to back.
I think you'll have a good time. Like I said, Peter David's pretty funny. He works a few jokes in there, but it's nothing that you need to get to right away or anything. Yeah, my Trojan horse. I mean, I have real indie comics books as well.
You read comics too?
No. Not at Christmas time.
Oh, that's right. None of those. Well, Stan Lee one's a comic book.
Yeah, it is. It's a total. The whole thing is sequential.
Oh, it's completely a comic.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
It's done as a total.
Word balloons.
I can see the.
How many pages is it?
It's the one I have is hardcover. It's about a little under 200 pages. So it's a pretty sizable. I mean, there's a fair amount of full page splashes too.
Yeah.
Like when they do the spotlights on Kirby and Steve and all that.
Next time,
I think you'll.
Next episode, I am going to have some Kirby related material from the 90s Tops comics Kirby stuff, where they took some.
Oh, you mean the episode? You mean the episode out by January 28th?
No, the episode out by the 14th.
We'll see. Got a busy end of the month. We'll see. But
14th. I assume you mean like March 14th.
And but Andrew, one of the things, one of the comics is featuring Kirby designs, but it's drawn by Ditko, and it's mid 90s, and it's pretty good.
Wow!
They fight aliens.
You know it's good if it's Steve.
But it was like Steve working on Jack in the 90s.
Wow!
After Jack's death.
But is this like mid-90s? Like he went from Valiant to working on Tops stuff?
Well, this limited series, at least. Secret Six. Because
he did some
City
like
City of the Six or something. Secret City.
Huh.
I forget what it's called. But
he did some wild stuff like some WWF and some stuff you wouldn't think of, normally think about, I don't think.
What else you got, Kevin?
Well, I've been doing a lot of reading, a lot of drawing. Well, not really drawing. I don't call it drawing, but anyways. It fuels the reading and all that stuff. I also read a lot of Turtles, but I think we've covered enough Turtles. I usually bring it up in whatever format. But the thing I settled on was something from Top Shelf. And it was Lost Dogs by Jeff Lemire. Like, I think it's
we have to have our minimum Canadian content requirement.
Oh, that's right. Did you see that Essex County is being developed by CBC for TV?
I get all my Canada comic news from you and Phil, so.
Oh, okay. I just thought that was interesting. Like, I would expect like someone else to have picked it up, but I'm like, well, I guess it was on that, like, CBC Reads, or there was some kind of reading, like, contest one year, and, like, Essex County was like, on, like, one of the finalists or something like that. I remember it kept on popping
Canada
up.
Canada
so.
Likes making crappy TV, can I say?
Plus, it's got all that hockey stuff in it. You guys love that stuff.
Of
Don't
course.
Speak well, for us all, Andrew.
I seem to remember someone had to delay recording this because they were watching hockey, Phil.
Definitely not me.
Well, the World Juniors was on. What can I say?
Oh, and you're watching freaking little kids play hockey. Juniors.
Well, I don't watch
any adults
play.
Watch some real hockey.
Let's keep this straight. I don't watch any adults play hockey.
That sounds so creepy.
Not without a few beers, at least.
There was the World Juniors, and then there was the regular hockey I go to. Obviously, I didn't go to Helsinki to watch that hockey. Like, you have to watch it on TV. Anyhow, this is too much hockey for one show, I think.
Yep.
Our southern U.S. listeners will start tuning out. But I think this was his earliest published work, this Lost Dogs. Because he has a big intro, like, I think it's like 3 pages. Had some, I don't know, 4 pages. Interesting material that I didn't know about how he was getting by and how he was producing comics. And, like, he had some other stuff that's unpublished where he kept on, like, restarting, like, these 100-page stories. Like, you know when creators are starting out, they're always like, oh, I want to do like that 500 issue series, and then they begin and then they never quite finish it, and it's like that's always a terrible starting point. And that's sort of his story. And then I think of his like career, how like this is pretty crazy. Just starting out as like a guy that gets a grant, funny enough, from one of the Turtles creator. I forget what the, I guess it's a Zurich grant, maybe I got that correctly, to publish this Lost Dogs, and it was like 700 copies, and then to think like where he is now, like that's pretty crazy. But this is this is some pretty rough stuff.
The Peter Laird, I think, started the Zurich grant.
Yeah. But apparently he applied several times to it for his like 300-page issue, whatever, massive opus type of thing, and he was denied. But when he applied for this Lost Dogs, like, he was accepted. And it's this like 8-foot tall guy that has like a striped red shirt, and it's basically his story. Like, his family's in here, but like horrible things happen to his family. And it, like, it sort of was birthed in a 24-hour comic, which I think is an interesting. I always enjoy like those types of experiments, and I think you're going in there thinking you might not find the greatest story, but part of the you reading those stories is like this was done in 24 hours, and you're just like, that is so like crazy of a challenge.
Mm-hmm. I always like those
Like, so, even just doing my own stuff, I'm like, yeah, that's something I just had to try out. It's sort of like the NaNoWriMo. Hey, let's write a novel in a month. Like, that seems stupid. That seems ridiculous. Let's do it. But this is all black and white except for the guy's red striped shirt. So I didn't fully expect this one. Like, you see the first few pages and you're like, okay, this is going to be like some family drama type of thing. And it gets so bleak and dark of a crime story. It is just ridiculous. Like, it definitely shows that emotional thing like he's always bringing to his stories. And I even thought of like one of his Bloodshot stories at one point. Of course, right? But I think I was more interested, like I have been today when I was trying to figure out what I was going to have on the show, was I just kept on staring at the artwork. Because it was just so rough. And sometimes you're like, oh yeah, those are like some of his characters with like the, like these characters, they look kind of ugly. And these are like even more so. And you sort of get into some boxing and some beatdowns and stuff like that. But it still had some, I think some interesting stuff. Like, you start to get into some of these fights where there's hundreds of panels, and I'm like, I like panels. Or, like, someone will be, something will be happening to someone, and, like, it'll be the same panel over and over again, but like, the first one is, like, painted, and then the next one is, like, real sketchy, and then like, the third page, you can barely see it. So he's trying out a lot of different techniques in here. So I find, like, that's probably makes the story more interesting. Because it's a little rough going, but the story carries you through. I thought it was really interesting. If you want to read, like, a bleak crime story, like, it is pretty heart-wrenching.
Any kids with antlers?
Make sure you have your meds on hand.
Take your meds first.
Yes.
Preventatively.
And so I just thought it was interesting to go back to like his early career and see all that stuff developing. Like, definitely worthwhile reading.
Well, I have a quick flashback. I don't know if you guys remember when I talked about the Kickstarter Cyrus Perkins and the Haunted Taxicab.
Yep.
Well, as part of my Kickstarter thing, I got sent the second issue digitally.
Awesome.
And this is Dave Dwanch and Anna Lencioni.
Do you get the print too eventually, or just the digital?
I don't remember what I signed up for, as usual, because I've backed way too many Kickstarters in my life. But I think what I did was I got the print of the first one and then digital of the other ones. Or maybe he just sent this as a courtesy because we backed it, because of all of us backed it. I don't remember. But it's from Action Lab. We've talked about those guys before.
Mm-hmm.
And the setup was the guy gets into the cab and he's dying. And then what happens is when he dies, he ends up sort of tethered to the cab. So Cyrus Perkins is the cab driver. And so Michael's like the student ghost, Michael Birnbaum, and he haunts the cab and he's stuck there. And so the second issue, so it seems like the overarching story is going to be like figuring out what happened to Michael, because he's got a bit of amnesia in it. You know, and they always got to have the ghost don't really know exactly what went on, or that wouldn't make much of a story. But on the day-to-day, issue-to-issue, it's going to be like a little procedural. Like in this one, Cyrus picks up a fare, and Cyrus can, or Michael can tell that the guy has a gun on him, and he's acting really weird. And so Cyrus ends up following the guy after he drops him off and stopping a crime. So it feels like it's going to be set up kind of like a TV show almost, where you have this overarching story of solving the murder, but on issue to issue they can have an adventure. And I just like the sensibilities and humor of you know, but it's got good tension. You don't know what's going to happen because it's just regular dude. Cyrus doesn't have any powers or anything. He's just a taxi cab driver.
I just think of heavy metal. I hear Taxi Cab Driver, and for some reason, I don't know.
Well, you don't think of DC?
Well, yeah, Space Cabby or heavy metal, I guess.
The title does seem a little... I don't know if it's a good title, but it's interesting, but
yeah,
doesn't Fred really Garvin, tell you where it's going to go. The sensibility.
I think it gets your, you know, it's make it your curiosity. You'd be like, what's this about?
But anyway, so if you like kind of a light crime book, check out Cyrus Perkins and The Haunted Taxi. I mean, it doesn't sound as grim as Kevin's, where, you know, he's killing children and having sex with corpses or anything, but...
That's while, the best stuff, though.
And while you're at it, check out all of Action Lab stuff.
Yeah,
because it's a pretty company. Cool company. Their Danger Zone is awesome.
But, well, didn't you have that Nutmeg cooking murder mystery comic that you were talking about? That had some.
And my Puppet Master comes out from them.
Yeah.
I say my Puppet Master, but that might not be correct.
That's because you're the one that's reading it, Phil.
Yeah, yeah, people are going to start thinking, oh, yeah, that's his comic.
Like, well, they only get one copy at my store, and that's just for me. I'm the only one that like, it's on the shelf always.
You know, you ever wonder about that sometimes? Like, I picked up some Valiant books there, and I sometimes wonder, I'm like, oh, man, am I the only one that, like, ordered this? But there's – I've been running into other Valiant fans.
I don't even order – they just know me so well there. They know I like horror comics, so they always make sure they at least have one for me.
Well, I mean, what they should be doing is telling us what you told us, and that is these comics are better than those terrible movies. So.
I also read Bandette Volume 2.
What was it, sorry?
Bandette.
Okay.
I finally got around to that. I just thought, because I think I talked about it first, and then Steve was like, "All Bandette!" And then
I really liked the first one. Yeah.
I didn't get around to like reading the second one until now, and I'm like, that's just terrible of me.
It was good.
I don't know if there's going to be like more. Well,
there'll
be more at some point, but...
But the next arc has started.
Has it?
Yeah.
Oh, man, somehow I totally blanked.
Yeah, they're on... let me look here. The 10 came out. It's the House of the Green Mask.
It's not... 10's not in the...
House of the Green Mask, Part 1. No, it's... House of the Green Mask, Part 1 is issue 10, and then another Urchin Stories came out. And now we're waiting. Tobin's done a couple other things, though, the writer. He's done... he's been cranking out the Plants vs. Zombies comics. My kids read them,
I thought he was
doing
Coulter.
Yeah, he's doing a whole bunch of stuff, but there's been an ongoing Plants vs. Zombie comic and a miniseries that run concurrently, and he's been cranking those out. And there's something else he was working on too besides the one you mentioned. So he's getting around. So hopefully they'll keep doing the Bandette.
I thought the second hardcover had like less issues, but it seemed to be the same size as the first one, which is this is kind
of
weird.
Well, it had a bunch of the Urchin Stories in it, if I'm not mistaken, too, right? I mean, it had the background.
Yeah, I thought... Yeah, and then I think there was the...
The first two do
the
first
prose story.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know if you read those, Steve.
It's
like, I'm there for the
pictures.
There for the comics. It's sort of like that debate people had about the artist and the writer. I'm like, I'm not there for the Bandette prose stories. That's not the reason I... bought it.
But the Urchin stuff has been really good. I thought they have good guests, like at least in the first one.
Yeah.
I like the guest creators.
Yep.
I kind of wonder if many of them are part of their studio or something. Like the Periscope studio there in Portland.
I do not know.
Yeah. Because I thought they had the guy that won the, was it the Marvel talent or the CBR talent contest a few years back. It was Patrick Scherberger?
Yes.
Or something like that?
Yes, he did the last Urchin Stories.
Yeah. Like I don't recognize a lot of names.
Which is 15.
It's all good.
Ron Randall.
I really like how creators now do that. Skull Kickers did that too, where they let other people come in and kinda
for the anthology episodes, or issues.
A fun way to keep your book going, you know, if you're having trouble hitting your deadline. It's always neat to see different takes on characters you like. Well, have you read that Plants vs. Zombies, Steve?
Your kids? My kids have. They like it very much. And Ron Chan, the artist, and Tobin are many times been paired up together at cons. And my 11-year-old has had the opportunity to meet him a couple of times and get his book signed and that kind of a thing. And Chan always draws in a little dudes and stuff. And the kids both played the games on the tablets, so they know all the characters and all that business. So they very much enjoy them.
Isn't that in that car commercial or something? I just remember some commercial where they're like, Plants vs. Zombies or something like that. Isn't that the game that's in that commercial? Or you don't get those commercials? You don't watch commercials? You don't see anything?
Even when commercials are on, I tend to not watch them unless there's, a cute girl involved.
It's just during the World Juniors, the commercials came on, and I just remember it was like over and over and over again. I'm like, holy jeez.
I think it's safe to say, I'm going to go on a limb, Kevin, you were the only one of the four of us watching the World Juniors Championship.
Why? You want me to just mention, when I was watching commercials one time, I happened to see, and then you'd be like, when were you watching commercials? And I'd be like, I don't normally watch commercials, but it was just something that was on over and over. I don't know if it must be the same thing with the NFL football. Like if they have a commercial they want you to see, it's like every commercial break, even twice during the same commercial break, they'll have the same thing playing over and over, and at some point you'll happen to see it.
I usually DVR and started about an hour or two into it, sometimes later, and that way you can just zip through the commercials.
So if someone checks to stay off the results, you'll be like, damn it!
Yeah, can't do that with a football
game. Not too many texting me sports, but that's what I do with football. I always watch it a little bit delayed.
All noted. I'll keep that in mind next time I'm tweeting you and shit.
Well, I just stay off the Twitters.
Andrew, what'd you think about those Bills, buddy?
If I can't go an hour without Twitter.
8-8, how about that? They finished 8-8 after all. Knocked the Jets right out of the playoffs. Aren't you psyched?
Between the time change and the fact that you've watched the games on rewind, I can really fuck with you.
Poor Andrew.
I do miss out on that. I don't get to, the Buffalo Bill podcast I listen to. I don't get to live tweet with them during the game. I'd much rather just watch it without all that, without the commercials and everything.
Yeah.
Doesn't that seem like the only thing you can live tweet is like live sports? Because after the game is done, like there's no one out there buying the DVDs or anything. Like, I don't know of anyone that waits till the next day to, like, that seems like of the moment. Like, if you're not there for that, like, it's pretty much worthless after the fact.
It's true. I forget where I was hearing or observing a conversation regarding spoilers in general and how, with sports, it's not really spoilers because it's, that's must-see TV. You got to watch it really right then. And then it's history, And they were talking about how some of the, reality singing competition shows are a little bit like that, too, where, like, that's fair game to talk about what happened the next day, because if you didn't watch it when it was on, too bad. You got to keep up on that kind of thing. That happens in the moment. But fictional stuff. Not that that stuff doesn't have its own degree of fictionalism to it, but with the fictional media stuff, there's a different anticipated culture. But
I don't know, boys. I'm telling you, try and do this with just one or two games. It'll turn your life around.
Oh, I know.
You just have to stay off the internet.
I'll come in late on a game and that I've already had like going on the TV and then rewind it and get that benefit of zipping through.
It's good. Yeah, I have to have this all this fancy tech then, to
do. If I died, am I in hell?
Yeah. It's true. It's Grindhouse.
Yeah, a DVR.
Grindhouse issue 25. Sports Talk Podcast Grindhouse.
Indie comic book noise is hell.
It's okay.
for you.